who has instituted one of the, I mean, maybe the case study for buybacks over dividends. Yeah, over a short period of time than I've ever seen. You know, their share prices appreciated from, you know, $3, I think, during the pandemic to as much as 450 recently.
Gosh.
Yeah, no, it's been amazing. And
that's amazing.
But that convexity is underscored by the company's commitment to their buyback.
Matt Warder, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Andy. Thanks for having me on. I love the chance to talk about coal whenever I get the opportunity, and happy to chat with your watchers and listeners about the sector as well. So,
yeah, well, I was really looking forward to having you on when I booked you. It's been a couple of weeks ago, and really what got me going, as I mentioned, I talked to two different analysts recently in the past 3 months, and they both, they're energy analysts, and they both talked to me or mentioned to me about coal. How they were very bullish on coal, and they thought that there was a lot of value there. And so that got me, and these are people that I really respected, and that got me really interested in coal because I never hear anything about it. I am completely naive, if you would, but I'm a deep value investor. And so they actually name dropped you and they said, you need to talk to Matt. So here we are. It's a little overwhelming. How do you give me a bullish case for coal, or just let's talk about coal at a very high level and then we'll go to a lower level, if you would.
So the easiest way to sort of tell the story, I think, is to talk about, you know, the energy transition is the top down, you know, government led, driver of the lack of demand for coal, right? And, you know, in the U.S. in particular, we've had, you know, a number of years whereby federal government has kind of cracked down on regulation in a number of different ways, whether that's in downstream demand with regards to electric vehicles or whatever, or, you know, upstream demand with regards to power plants. There's been a concerted effort to kind of push down coal production. And the difficulty with that is that coal isn't a local, I mean, it is a local market, but it's also this big global market as well, with a number of different sort of supply chain verticals. And the difficulty about top-down regulation is once the supply goes away, it has a real difficulty coming back. During the pandemic, there were a lot of mines that shut down here. And traditionally, you know, if you go back 5, 10, 20 years, the United States has been the swing supplier to the world for coal. So when production, you know, falls in Australia due to either floods or, acts of God or those sorts of things, the U.S. has usually been able to ramp up production to meet demand in the middle. And our ability to do that, the elasticity of coal supply has gone away, for lack of a better turn of phrase. So in these periods of where supply is really lacking, the ability of the industry to meet demand just isn't there. So we have marginal dynamics for supply. And we saw that most specifically during the run-up to the Russia-Ukraine war, where supply chains kind of rejiggered. The musical chairs of trade flows had to change. And in those situations, if you're a steel producer, you know, who needs to come into the market to buy a ton of coal, or you're a power producer who is fighting against ridiculously high natural gas prices, well, what are you willing to pay for that ton of coal that you need? And the answer is, well, I mean, technically the price is infinity when those occurrences happen. But in both metallurgical and thermal coal, we got up into the $500, $600 per ton, which is twice what any, for thermal coal is like 5X the past peak, 6X the past peak. For met coal, it was more like a double.
But wow.
Yeah, well, what that allowed the industry to do as a whole was to clean up their balance sheets.
Sure.
In the previous two cycles, there was a lot of M&A at the peaks. And the amount of debt that was issued to digest that proved to be too difficult to service at the trough. And once those companies came out of bankruptcy and then hit COVID, the ones that were able to survive the initial hit had the benefit of a 2021 and 22, which saw these ridiculous windfall prices, and they were able to clean up those balance sheets, which now puts them on the radar of value investors. And that's kind of how we got here. But that dynamic, that underlying dynamic about the inelasticity of supply, hasn't necessarily changed. So as long as that dynamic is in place, and there are some risk factors that could mitigate that in the future, then the potential for, one big year out of 5 or 6 or 7 is certainly there. And in the meantime, everybody's going to make a pretty decent amount of money, I think.
Not to interrupt you, that's exactly where I'm at. It became, as a value investor, it just had clothes just become on my radar, if you would. And I want to talk about specific companies in a second, but give me, again, let's talk about the misunderstanding of coal and really the supply demand balance or problem, if you would. And I think of it like China demand and also a lot of Asia demand. Mm-hmm. I think of that's how they are really the most economical way of fueling their economy, of getting them into Asia from third world countries to second world countries to first world and first world countries. In Asia, just to continue what they have. But yeah, talk to me about that.
Okay. It's kind of a big landscape. But let's start with the differential between the markets. So unlike other commodities, I guess oil, there's some analogs with oil, but coal isn't one thing. There are a number of different industries that coal supports. Most specifically, it is divided into two buckets. One is energy generation at the power plant level, baseload power plant level, that competes as a fuel with natural gas. And in recent years, natural gas has really been driving that bus, right? As natural gas prices go, coal is able to participate only as much as that price will let it, until demand increases to a point where you're forced to burn coal, or prices get to a point where you're forced to burn. On the other side, we have the steel industry. So, about 70-80% of global steel production, something like that, is produced by blast furnaces, which use metallurgical coal to make coke, which is carbon, basically. And then carbon serves as the reductant for iron ore, FeO2, to turn it into molten iron. So it's both the fuel and the reductant. Not all coals will make coke. Some of them turn into dust, right? But the few coals that do make charcoal, essentially it's kind of what coke is, have to be strong enough to hold up what's called the burden of blast furnace, which, if you imagine, a layer of charcoal and then a layer of iron ore over top of that, and then another layer of charcoal and a layer of iron ore. And then you fire the blast furnace with natural gas from below. It heats up the coke, which in turn heats up the iron ore, and the if that coke were to collapse, for instance, if it weren't strong enough to hold up the layers of material above it, then the molten metal couldn't trickle down to the bottom, and we siphon it off.
Okay, so this all makes sense now, and I'm going to just repeat it back to you so it's very simplistic for me. If we don't have coal, really, the world is not going to have the supply of steel.
Yes. You can't. The other way to make steel is through an electric arc furnace, where you're recycling steel that has already been made. Mm-hmm. But, the thing about materials is, if the world is going to grow, which we want it to, we want GDP to rise, we want people to grow over time, you can't recycle your way to growth. That's the sort of paradox about, the materials industry that is not, I don't think it's being talked about enough in progressive circles and those sorts of things. There's a narrative that at some point in time, energy is going to be free. So it's fine to build out all these AI data centers You know, we don't need to worry about copper, you know, to connect the wiring from, you know, from one to the other. And coal has kind of gotten lost in the mix because, you know, it's been lumped in with, well, thermal coal power plants are dirty. And,
right.
You know, the narrative around, you know, phasing out coal over the longer term in terms of energy generation. But really, that's just economics. I mean, it costs a little bit more to build a coal plant than a gas plant, at least domestically here in the U.S. So, of course, natural gas is good. For countries that are developing that may be closer to supply, the economics look a little bit different to them. So the way I kind of view thermal coal is like a transition from Western economies are leaving it behind, at least trying to. But that actually carves out, you know, a space for developing economies to use it when it makes economic sense. So I don't think thermal coal is going to go away necessarily. I think just Western economies are going to use less of it. And we're still going to produce. And, you know, as, you know, say, Sub-Saharan Africa develops, you know, they may choose to build more coal plants rather than vice versa. And China is basically the blueprint. You know, they burn more coal than anyone else in the world. And, you know, they've used that advantage to, you know, transition their vehicles. You know, they're leaders in EV production because they're powered by coal. But it's for them, it's a net gain. You know, for us, it's, you know, we have a lot of natural gas plants, which reduce carbon emissions, you know, incrementally. We have other avenues to thread that need. On the met coal side, again, you know, if we want more stuff, we have to have
some
modicum of blast furnace based steel production going on.
Yeah. So you brought up so many great points that leads me to so many more questions. So, and it makes me extremely interested in coal, right? Mm-hmm. So it's, my first question is the export factor, and two places come to mind. First is the U.S. exporting again to, I mean, if you just go across the Atlantic, you're looking at exporting to Africa, which the demand is, I don't know what the demand is, but I'm assuming it's
not that much at the moment. I mean, the U.S.'s natural markets are Europe and Brazil, basically.
Okay. So Europe had a natural gas problem 2 years ago, and I have immediate family in Europe. They use coal, I guess, is to get them through that. Mm-hmm. So I got it. So they're going to get their coal from here, if you would. My next question is, where is China getting their coal? Is it from here, or is it other places in the world, let's say Australia? Or
China mostly produces their own.
They do.
On the thermal coal side, they import a lot from Indonesia. China uses kind of lower grade coal. They use a lot of kind of under-spec, lower heat coals to fuel their power plants. Whereas India, you know, which is really the engine that's going to drive the next, you know, 10 years, 15 years of global growth. India built a lot of these power plants along the coastline that use much higher calorific value thermal. And they're going to import that from places like Australia, the United States, maybe a little bit from South Africa as well, on the thermal side.
Okay.
On the metallurgical side, China is, again, largely self-sufficient. They import a lot of material from Mongolia, and that really has, the Mongolian coal imports in China have really reduced their reliance on the seaborne market. A lot over the past few years. And that number is going to get bigger. Since the Russia-Ukraine war, China's also been importing a lot of Russian, specifically on the steel side. Now, they do import a little bit from a combination of Canada, Australia, and the United States. Typically, those coals are very strong coking coals. They need a modicum of external coal to contribute strength to the coke that I was talking about earlier, so we can hold up burdens, you know, more efficiently. But that reliance has become less and less over the years. So really, it's now India kind of driving the bus, and then when China comes into the market to pick off high quality cargoes, that's when we really get you know, price volatility to the upside moving. that make sense?
Yeah, no, it makes a lot of sense. And that makes a lot of sense. The next question I would have is, I keep on hearing Australia, and I'm assuming, well, let's not assume, who are the biggest coal producers in the world, if you would? And yeah, tell me about that and the strategically located, because then I would assume Australia is the best strategy or strategic location for exporting to Asia.
Well, I mean, the biggest players in the room are the diversified miners, the BHPs, the Anglo-Americans. There's been, BHP actually made an offer to absorb Anglo, here pretty recently, which has been, the story is mostly about copper.
Yep.
But it's not about metallurgical coal.
I didn't know that. I just thought it was a copper play.
Yeah. Well, Mike Henry, who is the CEO of BHP, used to run BHP's coal division in Australia. So he understands the value of what Anglo would add to the portfolio. I mean, if they absorb Anglo's coal business, that would basically give them total control of the premium low volatile metallurgical coal price, which is used as the benchmark basically for all the pricing around the world. So if you think about that, like if BHP controls ostensibly all PLV production, premium low vol PLV, then that gives them pricing power over the rest of the world. So they can really, essentially control what steel prices look like over the longer term, which is an intriguing factor, I think, for their C-suite, right?
Interesting.
Yeah, but obviously, Anglo's, mines and copper mines out there, it's pretty fantastic. And BHP has an interest in other copper producers in the region that would, let's just say make a really interesting district of operations, between Argentina and Chile, that would be able to kind of fuel a significant portion of the next boom in copper demand. Not all of it, mind you, but significant portion. So BHP and Anglo are probably the two biggest dogs in the room. Some other diversified miners are in the process of pretty much everybody who is diversified, with the exception of BHP and Glencore, is in the process of divesting. Glencore is actually in the process of taking it up, and BHP may be as well. But aside from those, like the pure play coal companies.
Yeah, talk to me about that.
Yeah, that we need to pay attention to going forward, at least in my view. First off, let me sort of say that the decline in thermal coal consumption is kind of a concern from a pricing standpoint. As long as there's going to be cheap natural gas available, that does limit the near-term upside for thermal coal prices.
Got it.
Metallurgical coal, on the other hand, what you see is what you get. So until end users find ways around using higher quality materials, the landscape is basically flat, in terms of supply. There's a few projects coming on, but not a whole lot over the longer term.
And so in other words, you're going to pay for it.
Yeah, exactly. And so I'm much more optimistic about metallurgical coal's price regime going forward than I am about thermal coal. And from an investment standpoint, that's how I'm pressing my exposure as well. The two companies that I would highlight in the United States for U.S. markets to that end are pure play metallurgical coal producers. First is Alpha Metallurgical Resources, ticker AMR, who has instituted maybe the case study for buybacks over dividends. Over a short period of time than I've ever seen. Their share prices appreciated from $3, I think, during the pandemic, to as much as $450 recently.
Gosh.
Yeah, no, it's been amazing. And
that's amazing.
But that convexity is underscored by the company's commitment to their buyback. Okay. 12.5 shares still outstanding. They've retired around 35% of the float already, just over the last couple of years.
Are they taking a private?
I couldn't tell you.
Right. Sure. Sure. I'm just thinking out loud. That's just really aggressive.
Yeah. It's kind of immaterial to me. I'd like to be the, I'd like to be holding the last share.
Right.
Whenever that happens.
Exactly.
We'll see if they can, they can get it off my hands, I'm sure. But, right. But that's kind of how I've been approaching it. So I didn't ride them the whole way. I kind of jumped on in midstream. The company that I rode for the initial COVID wave was Arch, which was growing production at the time. Their operations are now sort of ramped up, so they're kind of market performers. But the next big, growth in free cash flow is going to come from Warrior Metcoal, which is ticker HCC. So Warrior operates mines in Alabama, whereas AMR operates mines in Central Appalachia. And the difference in cost to the export market is really marked by logistics, transportation. So from West Virginia, it costs, let's just call it around $50 per short ton to get the coal to port. Whereas in Alabama, which is much closer to the Gulf anyway,
right?
You can get coal down there for $30, $35. So there's a, $10 to $20 delta at any one point in time, which favors Alabama costs. In addition, they're putting in another mine. So they're actually going to grow production by the time we get to 2027. I think their new longwall should be ramped up.
Great info.
Yeah. And that mine is going to be, which is called Blue Creek, is going to be a high quality, it's a higher volatile metallurgical coal, but it can essentially be used as a substitute for, premium mid-vol Australian production. So in coke makers around the world know how to use coals from that seam, which is called the Blue Creek seam, and the overriding seam above that, which is called the Mary Lee. Those coals are very well branded in the global market. They're the chemistry and the rheological properties of those materials are very well known. Everybody knows how to use them in their blend to some extent. So they should be able to place that coal no problem. And the margins that they'll be able to generate from it. I mean, this is a mine that's going to make, ostensibly somewhere between $80 to $120 a ton for the life of operations, at least, as I see the market going forward. So multiply that by, 4 million tons, that's a lot of dough.
That's a lot of money.
Yeah. So I think at their peak, and this is at a relatively conservative forward estimate of met coal at, called around $225. Warrior will generate somewhere around $800 million of free cash flow, like
wow,
pure cash per year. When the mine is fully ramped up in 2027, which obviously could fuel a buyback program of pretty epic proportions.
Yeah, that sounds like another one. Interesting.
Yeah, so that's the one I think is going to grow over time. I think it's still underappreciated in the market. Whereas AMR is a more mature story at this point in time, with an executive suite that I think is probably unparalleled to anyone in the industry.
Yeah,
they're great communicators. They're very transparent and accountable. You know kind of what you're getting, as long as they commit to returning cash flow to the buyback, there's going to be upside convexity to that stock over time, as well. So those are the two horses that. That I'm riding currently, for better or for worse going forward. The other two that I'd mentioned, Peabody, ticker BTU, which is usually when people think about coal companies that are publicly traded, that's the first one that comes to mind. Peabody's been around for a couple hundred years.
Yeah.
It's kind of like grandfather of all coal companies.
Yeah.
Peabody is also bringing on a very high quality metallurgical coal mine in Australia called Centurion, which should add about $300 million of free cash flow to their bottom line by the time it's fully ramped in a couple of years. And they have, sort of had a come to Jesus moment with regards to buybacks as well. They're likely to use that cash flow to do likewise. And the other company is Whitehaven, which is an Australian producer. Whitehaven just bought two metallurgical coal mines from BHP, Blackwater and Daunia. So not quite premium grade coal, but the cost structure at those mines is excellent. And the margins are going to be excellent over time. But Whitehaven went from being a pure play, high calorific value, a thermal coal producer to now kind of a 50-50 hybrid between met and thermal, and which is very similar to BTU. And then on the pure thermal coal side, the company that I highlight there are a few, but Consol, ticker CEIX in the US, would be the first one that I'd draw attention to. Again, another executive suite that's excellent communicators. Jimmy Brock is, one of the best CEOs in coal mining history, and absolute straight shooter, and another transparent, accountable company. They have the lowest cost thermal coal operations in the U.S. They have these big longwall operations in southwestern Pennsylvania. They can mine coal for $35 per short ton. And have favorable rates to get the coal to port, which has been interrupted here. There was a bridge in Baltimore that collapsed not too long
ago, yeah.
Which has interrupted trade. Those shipping channels should be clear by the end of the month, and they'll be back in business with regard to that.
So by
I think so. The great thing about Consol is that cost structure is going to be intact for a very long time. And they are the low cost provider to Europe, and to India. And I think what you take that to mean is the thermal coal price can only go so low, as to keep Consol in the market. So their free cash flow is going to be, positive for a long period of time. They have a little bit of metallurgical coal production as well. Not a lot. But they can sell some of their thermal coal into the met market. They have a little bit of flexibility there. But as the low cost provider, that provides them a lot of leverage and a lot of staying power in the market as well. Those are the five that I mostly focus on, for better or for worse, that kind of give me exposure to the broader market. If you have any questions about others, I'm happy to go into those.
Well, I think really, and that was excellent. I was going to ask you a bunch of other follow-up questions that you already answered. I mean, which is great. One of the follow-up questions I was going to ask was Australia and Australian producer. And I think of that strategically because of shipping lanes and routes to that side of the world. And also I have a lot of listeners, if you would, and viewers from Australia.
Oh, interesting.
Which I find interesting. I'd like just comment on this is I had a guest on, Trader Ferg. You might know him. He thinks the world of you.
Well, that is reciprocated 100%. Yeah. Ferg's a great guy.
I'm going to give him a shout out here. Yeah. He goes, "You're having Matt on? Oh man, make sure you send me that video if you would." I will. So Trader Ferg, a shout out, but he really looks at, small bankrupt companies or companies that are coming out of bankruptcy, if you would. And he's very interested in coal. I guess what was marrying that together? What is your, not so much ticker symbols or stocks, but what is your recommendation to somebody that's looking at really smaller plays that are looking to go bigger, if you would? Yeah. How do you find those and discover that if you would?
In the coal space, it's a really small universe, right?
Yeah.
Trader
Ferg and you.
Just the number of companies, it reminds me of the closest analog that I have is the shipping industry, right?
Okay.
Now shipping is this really sort of small community of companies. I forget how many there are, 17, 20 publicly traded equities.
Yeah.
The industry is very close-knit, and they're very open about information sharing. And especially on Twitter, there's a lot of folks you can follow for shipping who can explain that industry to you as well. And there's a lot of volatility. So if you're trading, that's your friend. If you understand the dynamics of, how rates swing up and swing down, you can position yourselves accordingly and make a lot of money. Coal's kind of the same way. There's only a handful of publicly traded equities. Tapping the micro cap universe there aren't that many. There is one I think is sort of interesting, but it has it's got some hair on it, so to speak. The one smaller cap coal that I've made a little bit of money on in the past is a company called Corsa, which is ticker CSO on the TSX Venture Exchange. They are basically a single asset producer, which gives them, you know, a lot of risk in terms of production. They're higher cost, which is not great. They have a little bit of debt, which is not great because their margins are basically zero at the moment. They make the vast majority of their money on the domestic market. And it just so happened the domestic market for metallurgical coal last year, those contracts are settled on an annual basis. And they settled, I think, in August, early September, right before the metallurgical coal market took off, which has become a bit of a seasonal phenomenon because of India. If you think about India's weather patterns, they have a monsoon season that lasts basically from, you know, May until August or early September. So they try not to get a lot of cargoes delivered during that period of time. So they come into the market basically in July to buy cargoes for September. So it takes a couple of months for that activity to begin to ramp up. And Corsa just kind of, I don't want to say settled too early, but there was a truck accident at one of BHP's mines in Australia that started to send prices to the moon, and they probably settled or so before that. So they got a little bit unlucky.
Yeah, not later.
Yeah, but going forward, I think prices for met coal have become relatively predictable in the short term. I think we've kind of hit market balance and equilibrium to some degree. So, you know, kind of a floor of like $200 and a ceiling of $400 is kind of how I think about prices going forward. If Corsa is able to kind of wait out the market here in the fall and get a pretty good FOB mine price, you know, they could have some upside potential in 2025. We have to wait and see where prices are in August to be sure.
Yeah.
But that is one operation that, you know, could have kind of some interesting performance going forward. We'll see. It's dependent, market dependent. But as far as microcaps are, that's kind of, you know, they're almost the only play.
Sounds like I should have you on in August.
Yeah, well, that is the time to start, you know, really thinking about, you know, leveraging up positions. We'll have a better feel for what China and India demand are going to look like when it comes down to August. This is a pretty typically quiet period for coal markets here through June at least. So
got it.
But anyway, that's, yeah, on the microcap side, Corsa is interesting. I think it's CRSXF is the over the counter ticker. The bare minimum of volume, like there's no volume. So like it's not one to chase or put market orders in, you know, use limit orders.
Yeah.
You know, be very,
Fred, buyers careful. Beware.
Yeah.
That's right. You can blow that one out of the water pretty quickly and people wonder what happened.
Excellent. Well, Matt, I think we should wrap up here. If people want to do business with you or work with you or be in contact with you, how do they do that?
Sure. Well, the first thing you can do is I just recently took over a website, thecoaltrader.com. Our friend David Dyer started this website with an eye to be, you know, kind of the independent voice for coal markets, you know, to the investor community. He just recently took a job at Ramaco Resources, which is another company I didn't get to talk about, which is another met coal company that is pretty interesting and also growing, ticker METC. But I've taken over the day-to-day operations of that website. So you can find me there at thecoaltrader.com. You can also find me on Twitter at MFWater. That's pretty much it. You can also follow at thecoaltrader on Twitter. There's a news feed that I hope to automate and get up and running here, up and running again pretty quickly, at Coal Newswire, also on Twitter. But those are the handles you could find me at. Yeah, and, you know, please feel free to reach out anytime.
Yeah, I'll tell everybody that Matt is very responsive and also very gracious. So there's a plug for you.
We try to be. Yep. It's, you know, I've been in the industry for 20 years as a market analyst, and there's never been this level of interest for the sector. And so to the extent that I can be of help to, you know, generalists and non-experts, I'm always happy to be because you know, the sector definitely needs a voice, and we need retail investors to participate in order to get the best returns we can. So,
yeah, that would all be me. Well, Matt, I want to thank you so much for your time again. I just had a great time and I'd love to have you on again in August.
I'm happy to come on anytime. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, Matt.